step by step.
Welcome to the Fort Lauderdale Primary Purpose Big Book Study Group Thursday Night Alcoholics and God Speaker Step Series. We're going to have Guy come up and tell our joke.
Alcoholic member of this group, my name is Guy.
Hey, Guy.
Right here. Take me to your sponsor, Best Jokes and Cartoons from AA Grapevine. All right. It's called Memory Lane. Three women friends were sitting around the kitchen table doing what they enjoyed to do, drinking beer by the case. One woman said, "I wonder if all this beer is affecting my memory. This afternoon I saw an open jar of mayonnaise on the counter. I couldn't remember if I'd finished my sandwich or I'd put it out to make one." "I know what you mean," the second woman said. "Yesterday I found myself in the middle of the stairs. I couldn't remember if I was going up or down." "We've all had as much beer as you," the woman said. "I've never had any memory problems at all, and I hope I never will." With that, she reached over, quickly knocked on the wooden table, and said, "Oh, somebody's at the door. I'll get it."
Quick announcement. There was a phone found in the restroom. It's a red iPhone. Okay, here you go, ma'am. You're welcome. You're lucky we're recovered now. I would have sold it. I'm a recovered alcoholic, and my name is James. We're going to introduce our secretary to come up and do the secretary's report quick. That is Spencer.
Hey, Spencer, recovered alcoholic secretary. In keeping with the seventh tradition, which states that every group shall be fully self-supporting, declining outside contributions, the baskets are now going around. If you happen to forget your wallet at home, but you still have a phone because you found it in the bathroom, there's QR codes on the back of the chairs. You can Venmo. I've asked Jennifer to read the recovered statement. We read this notice to explain why many people in AA identify as recovered rather than recovering and what it exactly means to Jessica. I'm sorry. It's Jessica. Ooh.
Hi, everyone. I'm an alcoholic, and my name is Jessica. Recovered. We are not cured of alcoholism. Recovered. But not cured. That presents a conflict to some alcoholics. If we were cured, we would be able to drink responsibly. No, we are not cured. The allergic reaction to alcohol will remain with us for our lifetime, but we have been restored to sanity. That was the problem. The main problem of the alcoholic centers in his mind rather than the body. Page 23. We are now sane where alcohol is concerned. Consequently, we have recovered.
All right. 1940-style Big Book sponsorship from Forward to Second Edition, Alcoholics Anonymous, of alcoholics who came to AA and really tried. 50% got sober at once and remained that way. 25% sobered up after some relapses. And among the remainder, those who stayed on with AA showed improvement. What we've seen, felt, come to believe, and experience is that God has not changed over time, and neither should the sacred approach back to his loving arms. The statistics above suggest a 75% success rate. If anyone is looking for a sponsor, please stand. All right, we got a couple. If you're too shy to stand, please go by the piano and somebody will come accost you. Can all the recovered alcoholics please raise your hand? All right. If your hand was not raised, we suggest that you hang out with those who were. And now we have screen announcements. And screen announcements are Intergroup is where you can buy AA-related literature and medallions. Intergroup is also responsible for creating our where and when and scheduling the AA hotline. Stop by and visit them. Broward County Institutions Committee is responsible for bringing meetings into places where people like us can't get out, such to AA meetings such as jails, detoxes, and rehabs. They meet monthly to organize the meetings at the 12-step house. Do we have any members of BCIC here tonight? All right, we got a couple over there. If you have any questions, go ahead and talk to them. And here are some upcoming service opportunities. And we also have flyers in the back. First one is AA's Got Talent. That's going to be on Sunday, January 12th at 12:30 p.m. There are no spots left for performers, so you're out of luck. All right. Save the date. The next Appreciation Banquet planning meeting will be Wednesday, January 22nd at 6:15 p.m. And that's at the Intergroup Bookstore. And then we have Tom M. This is his first night, and he'll be here through February 6th. So we'll have him for 6 weeks. Of course, our Monday night Big Book Study. We meet here in this room at 7:15. Fellowship begins at 6:30. It's also on Zoom now, so you can go and check that out from the comfort of your own home. And back to this, we have CDs, mugs, large print, big books, and little red books for sale. We meet every Thursday, starting promptly at 7:15, and we ask that you be courteous and ready to begin at the Road to Recovery tune. See you next week. Thank you.
Thank you, Spencer. Thanks for joining us tonight. In a minute, we're going to start our two-minute meditation, so please take a moment to get situated. Please turn off all devices that make noise or might distract others. Take this time to get connected to God and let the craziness of the day drift away, and ask God to help you stay focused on the step study tonight. If we're ready, we're going to bring in the monks and dim the lights. Welcome back. We're going to say the Foglight Prayer. It's up here on the screen. It's on the chair backs, the yellow card, if you don't know it. God? There's a solution from the Big Book, page 17. The tremendous fact for every one of us is that we have discovered a common solution. We have a way out on which we can absolutely agree and upon which we can join in brotherly and harmonious action. This is the great news this book carries to those who suffer from alcoholism. I've asked Connor to read Appendix 2, Spiritual Experience. We read this because the main purpose of the 12 steps is to have one, so it's kind of important to know what one is. Please welcome up Connor.
Connor, member of Alcoholics Anonymous.
Connor.
Spiritual experience. The terms spiritual experience and spiritual awakening are used many times in this book, which upon careful reading shows that a personality change sufficient to bring about recovery from alcoholism has manifested itself among us in many different ways. Yet it is true that our first printing gave many readers the impression that these personality changes or religious experiences must be in the nature of sudden and spectacular upheavals. Happily for everyone, this conclusion is erroneous. In the first few chapters, a number of sudden revolutionary changes are described. Though it was not our intention to create such an impression, many alcoholics have nevertheless concluded that in order to recover, they must acquire and immediate an overwhelming God consciousness, followed at once by a vast change in feeling and outlook. Among our rapidly growing membership of thousands of alcoholics, such transformations, though frequent, are by no means the rule. Most of our experiences are what the psychologist William James calls the educational variety, because they develop slowly over a period of time. Quite often, friends of the newcomer are aware of the difference long before he is himself. He finally realizes that he has undergone a profound alteration in his reaction to life, that such a change could hardly have been brought about by himself alone. What often takes place in a few months could seldom have been accomplished by years of self-discipline. With few exceptions, our members find that they have tapped an unsuspected inner resource which they presently identify with their own conception of a power greater than themselves. Most of us think that this awareness of a power greater than ourselves is the essence of a spiritual experience. Our more religious members call it a God consciousness. Most empathetically, we wish to say that any alcoholic capable of honestly facing his problems in the light of our experience can recover, provided he does not close his mind to all spiritual concepts. He can only be defeated by an attitude of intolerance or belligerent denial. We find that no one need have difficulty with the spirituality of the program. Willingness, honesty, and open-mindedness are the essentials of recovery, but these are indispensable. There is a principle which is bar against all information, which is proof against all arguments, and which cannot fail to keep a man in everlasting ignorance. That principle is contempt prior to investigation. Herbert Spencer.
Thank you, Connor. Please refrain from disturbing others by talking or constantly getting up and sitting back down. This is a tech-free meeting, so turn your phone off or put it on airplane mode or silent. We have Tom M. tonight, super excited. Love when Tom's in town. He's all the way from Prescott, Arizona. So please give Tom a nice round of applause.
Thank you, James. My name's Tom, and I'm an alcoholic. And so did you think that joke was funny? I love this, you know. I got a few jokes of my own. I always keep a couple of jokes, you know, or riddles, you know, because I like to see how smart you are, you know. So, do you know what the law student and a recovering alcoholic have in common? They both got to pass the bar. do you know why? Children of recovered alcoholics
have such big family reunions? They got 12-step parents. Okay. That's enough, okay? I won't torture you anymore. I'll torture with my story, okay? That's what I'll torture you with. Anyway, I just celebrated 41 years on December 9th. I got sober December the 9th, 1983. And that's not when I got here, though. And I got here a long time ago. I was 21 years old. I'm 72 now. And I was talking to the guys before the meeting about how I came to Florida. It wasn't of my own free will. Most of the things that have happened to me were not of my own free will, you know. I always say I've been thrown out of everywhere in my life except two places, you know. I never got thrown out of jail. I only got thrown into jail. And I never got thrown out of Alcoholics Anonymous. I was asked to leave. But they told me I could come back, you know. And if I wasn't drinking, it would probably be better. But, yes, and I have a home group. I have two home groups, actually, because I got sober here. You know, and I spent 38 years of my life here. That wasn't by my own free will either. I kind of had a choice, you know. I'm from Illinois. I was born in Springfield, Illinois, and raised in Peoria, Illinois. And I spent a lot of time in Arizona in the early 70s. And I worked construction my whole life. So I would go back and forth between, and my father was the one that came down here in 72, and he was a construction superintendent, when they were building Coral Springs. And there was nothing out there in those days except a 7-Eleven and a Chinese restaurant and a bar, of course, you know. You had to have a bar so the construction workers would have some place to go. But he was here in 72, and I was in 79 in the courtroom in Peoria, Illinois, with about 26 charges against me, waiting to be arraigned. And he had made it big, you know. He had the house on the ocean and driving a new Jaguar, and I hadn't seen him in a couple of years. And all of a sudden, he walks into the courtroom in Peoria, Illinois, from all the way from Florida, with the highest paid criminal attorney in town, which I knew because I belonged to the laborers union all my life. 50 years I've been in the laborers union. And his brothers were in the laborers union with me, Don Hamm. And they went up and they talked to the judge right in the middle of the court, and then they went and sat down, and the judge called me up. I wondered what was going on. He put his hand over the microphone and he leaned across to me and he said, "Well, Mr. Matthews, you got two choices. You can go to the Illinois penitentiary or you can go with your father to Florida." I said, "Well, Your Honor, I guess we're going to Florida, you know." "That's right," he said. "Don't ever come back to Illinois or I'll make sure you go to the penitentiary." So that I didn't get here by my free will either. And they threw me out of the Army at 21 because I was a heroin addict. You know, I started out drinking. You know, I'd rather put it like this. I started out as a kid a long time ago knowing that there was something wrong with me. I didn't know what it was that was wrong with me. But I knew that there was something wrong with me. I didn't fit in. I didn't play with you very well, you know. I was not the kind of person you could tease because I might hit you in the back of the head with a rock or something's going to happen, you know. And I was always scrapping with other kids all the time. And I don't know, I just, you know, I grew up out in the cornfields. And back in the 50s, you know, and you probably have seen those old science fiction movies, you know, on Svengoolie or TCM or someplace, you know, with the flying saucers and stuff. And I used to lay up in my bed at night and I'd look out at the cornfield, and I used to imagine that a flying saucer was going to land out there in the cornfield, and they were going to pick me up, and they were going to take me where I belonged, where I was probably the king, you know. I should be the king of some planet, that, and they put me on the wrong planet, you know, because I didn't fit in here, and I didn't get along with people, and I didn't get along with authority at all, you know. I'm Irish Catholic, and I went to Catholic schools my whole life, and the nuns started on me in the second grade. They would grab me by the ears and shake my head violently, you know, because I never really wanted to learn what they wanted to teach me. I never really wanted to learn what anybody wanted to teach me. I only wanted to know what I wanted to know. And I wasn't interested in other people's ideas, only in my own. And by the time the Christian Brothers were done with me in high school, they were using their knuckles on me out back. And then I got in the Army, and the first sergeant told me, he said, "You won't go to the stockade, but you'll go out back with a couple of the platoon sergeants." Because nobody goes to the stockade in my outfit. It's going to make me look bad. I grew up in a very violent life. I started running with a gang in the fifth grade, the second time through the fifth grade. The first time I was still living in the country. The second time, the old man had moved us into town. And for the first time, I found people that I felt like I belonged with. So that was really important to me. You know, it gave me a sense of belonging. I'd never had a sense of belonging up until that time. And, you know, as time went by, you know, I mean, we rumbled, you know. We're this little greasy hair back, wear the black leather jackets, carry switchblade kind of kids, you know. And we like to rob everybody and steal and, you know, candy. We used to say candy's dandy, but I'll bet you liquor's quicker. And so we started stealing liquor. And after the first time I got drunk at 13, I found a bottle of wine in the woods. Big, we call it Dago Red, you know. Italian Chianti with the straw bottle glass. And some other kid had stashed it there. And it was about 10 below zero. And it was so cold, you know, that the ice, it was starting to freeze, the wine was. And I thought, I want to see what it's like to get drunk. And I better drink this as fast as I can before somebody else comes along and wants it, right? And I can still remember the wine going down my throat and the ice melting in my throat as it went down and warmed me up out in the cold. And I fell in love. I fell in love with that feeling. Because now everything was fine. There was no more. See, I learned from Alcoholics Anonymous what it was, is restless, irritable, and discontent. I was restless, irritable, and discontent my whole life until I found that bottle of wine in the woods. And I fell in love with it. Because it was the medication that I used and would continue to use in this, any substance to medicate my alcoholism. Alcohol didn't make me an alcoholic. Drugs didn't make me a drug addict. Addiction and alcoholism are two different things. We can become addicted, but alcoholism, my alcoholism, is a disease that centers in my mind. And it's a talking disease. It talks to me. And it tells me, you know how to run your life. And you know how to run everybody else's life. And you know the way life ought to run. And if life would just run your way, everything would be wonderful. And it won't shut up. It squawks all the time until I use a substance to quiet it, to quiet that mind. So, you know, there's a lot of people, I know that come to Alcoholics Anonymous that aren't real alcoholics. God bless you, you know. I mean, we got room for everybody. Love and tolerance is our code. And, you know, we started stealing liquor, and, of course, we were popular because we had all the liquor, you know. We were the party boys, and everybody partied with us, and we supplied everybody. And, of course, then the 60s started to come along, and everybody started turning on and turning off to liquor. And they would say to me, "Oh, come on, you know, you want to smoke some weed?" And I'd say, "No, I don't want. You'll turn into a heroin addict." And they'd say, "Oh, that's crazy. You're not going to turn into a heroin addict. You know, that's not going to happen to you." And what happened to me was it got where there was nobody else except me and one other guy that were still drinking, and then we were ostracized. Remember when I talked about that fifth grade situation where I found people I belonged with, now I didn't have people that I belonged with anymore. And I couldn't have that, you know. So I went to my friend, and we went all over town, tried to find some weed, couldn't find any. And then he tells me, he goes, "Well, I got some mescaline." I said, "Give me that. I just want to get high, you know. I'm ready to go." Then we found some weed, and we tripped and smoked weed all night. And then we stopped stealing liquor, and we started stealing drugs. And then we were breaking into the drug warehouse down on the Illinois River, the McKesson Robbins Drug Warehouse. And they only had single-hung windows in those days, and they didn't lock up the barbiturates and amphetamines. They were just on the shelf in the warehouse, bottles of 1,000, Seconals, Amitols, Tuenols, Dexedrines, Black Beauties, White Crosses, you know. And we were just selling them to get acid and weed, you know. And then my buddy's brother, when I was 17, come back from Vietnam. And he said, "My brother, he was a Marine. He was in the Battle of Khe Sanh, 68, in the Tet Offensive." And he said, "My brother's shooting reds all day, drinking a case and a beer and a bottle of whiskey just to keep his habit down, and he'd go for these 3-grain Tuenols. They were the strongest barbs in those days. And in those days, before they put a gelling agent in it, you could just put it into a spoon on cold water and stir it up and bang it. And I watched him do that, and I watched how fast he got messed up, because, you see, I like to get messed up fast. I don't like to fool around about getting messed up. I mean, I want to feel it now. You see, I don't understand anything about social drinking, you know. And, of course, I never met any social junkies before, you know. I mean, I don't know what a social junkie is, you know. But I kind of have an idea, because in my 20s I lived with a woman, and she was the president of the Bartenders Union. And she would go out on Saturday night. She had the Pier Marquette Hotel, the bar in the Pier Marquette Hotel, the best hotel downtown Peoria and on Main Street. But I go to the bar every night, the neighborhood bar, you know. And I like whiskey and beer. You know, I never had a martini or a Tom Collins or none of that stuff. I don't know anything about that, you know. Whiskey, beer, and wine, I know a lot about, you know. And so, you know, I drink shots and beers. And she liked to drink schnapps on the rocks in a jigger, you know. And the ice would melt in her glass. And I never had a drink in my life that the ice melted in my glass. I've never had a soft drink that the ice melted in my glass, okay? And, you know, I mean, Saturday night, 3 deep at the bar, you know, she's talking to girls, I'm talking to guys. You know, after a couple hours, I've had about 15 shots and beers, and I'm looking at the melted ice in the glass, and I I say, honey, you want another drink? And,
oh, no, I'm starting to feel it.
And I used to think, what is wrong with this woman? You know, she's a prude. She doesn't know how to have a good time, you know. What's that supposed to mean? I'm starting to feel it. You don't want more? No, because you see, when I'm starting to feel it, it's time for more. It's not time to go home, okay, because it's really, I don't go home, okay. I mean, I go, you know, from the 1 o'clock joint downtown to the 4 o'clock joint and then to the after hours joints, you know, that we come out when 6, when the bars open again. Because most of the bars in Peoria only closed for 2 hours. There's 3 shifts, you know, and they got to just swamp the bar out, you know, so that they can get the 3rd shift in there from Caterpillar. That's who I used to work for, Caterpillar's contractor, doing all the concrete work around the plants. And, you know, that went on for a while, listening to all them stories about the wonderful life of drugs and dealing in the military, you know, and how wonderful that was. So as soon as I turned 18, I joined the Army. Not because I was a patriot. And I didn't even care that the Vietnam War was going on. I wanted that, what he had had. I wanted that lifestyle. And, you know, the Army usually doesn't give you what you want, so they sent me to Germany instead. I'd have gone to Vietnam just to get the dope. You know, and I was combat arms. I wasn't some radio man or something. I was a tanker. And they sent me to Germany, but I found what I wanted there. And, you know, and I knew what they needed there so that I could get into the gang. You know, they had no psychedelics, so I took an ounce of mescaline with me. That got me right in the gang. You know, dealing all the morphine and the hashish, you know, And you know, they started getting kind of upset with us over time. And now the Vietnam War was coming to an end. They wanted to get rid of us and start the volunteer army. And so they threw us out by the thousands. They gave us general under honorables, you know, for being heroin addicts. And they locked us up, you know, in hospitals, you know, for a few months. And my old man had come down here in 72. And so in 73, they brought me down here to the VA hospital in Miami. They wanted to give me treatment. I didn't want nothing to do with it. And I just wanted out. I'd been locked up in hospital wards for 3 months, you know. Didn't no exercise even. And so I went out the back door to VA hospital down in Miami, had a duffel bag full of uniforms, and I threw them in the dumpster. And I said, I'll never shave or cut my hair again, you know. And I went to the taxi stand, and I told the cab driver, take me to Pompano Beach. And he said, you mean Pompano? And I said, I don't know what the hell I mean. I'm from Illinois, you know. I never been here before. My old man said, you know, I didn't have nothing, no car. They took my rank, my money, you know. He said, I got no job for you on my job. He wasn't too happy with me. He says, but he was living in Coral Springs, and over on Riverside, they were just building the first city of Coral Springs water treatment plant. He said, you can go down there and get a job. $2 an hour, chopping through solid rock, all straight time. First paycheck, 60 hours, $105 after they took the taxes out. My brother had already had enough, and he's up in the union in Peoria. He told me, just save your money, get an old car, and get up here, and I'll get you in the union. But, you know, they told me don't drink because, you know, I had hepatitis from shooting dope with some other guy that had hepatitis. And so, you know, I didn't last very long with not drinking. Because I don't have nobody to hang around with. I mean, you know, I mean, construction workers, all they talk about on the job all day is what happened in the bar last night. And all they talk about in the bar when they get there is what happened on the job today. You know, that's the way construction workers are, you know. So I had nobody to talk with about anything, you know. And So I started with drinking, and one night I was with this other vet, and we were out at the VFW in a plantation at a dance. And the last thing I can remember, we both had our own bottles of whiskey, no, vodka, and we were sucking that vodka down, and the last thing I remember before I went in a blackout was the two of us rolling around on the ground beating the hell out of each other, you know. I'm a good friend of yours, you know. That's the kind of stuff I do, you know, because I think you might have said something I didn't like. And when I came out of the blackout, I was laying on a gurney. I didn't know where I was. All I knew, I was in the hospital, and I was in the Broward General Hospital over on Sample Road. And I sat up, and my nose was killing me, and there was a sink and a mirror there, and I looked at my face in the mirror. My nose was split wide open. My face was all fucked up. Excuse my language. And all I could think of is, I got to get out of here. I can't stay here. I got to get out. And I got up, and I put my clothes on, and the nurses got me before I could get out the door. And they said, "Where are you going?" I said, "I'm leaving." They said, "Oh, no, you can't leave." I said, "What are you talking about? I got no money. I can't pay you. I'm leaving." They said, "Oh, no, you can't leave." "Well, what do you mean I can't leave?" "Oh, the state police are out here in the lobby. They want you." Now, did you ever get this look from people when you answer them and you say, "For what?" And they look at you like their mouth's hanging open. "What do you mean, for what? You don't know." "Know what?" "You don't know that you hit a carload of people out at Sample and Powerline. And in those days, that was all bell peppers and cucumbers and lettuce, all right? That was the country." And there was a lot of little kids in that car, and they're going to need plastic surgery. "You don't know you hit them?" I said, "I don't even have a car." They said, "Well, you were driving your buddy's pickup." I said, "Where's he?" And they said, "Well, he doesn't have any right eyebrow anymore. He went through the windshield. We sewed him up, and we sent him home. And you broke the steering wheel with your face. That's what happened to you." And so I was in trouble. I was in big trouble. And I was going to, the construction had fell off, and I was going to BCC on the GI Bill just to have a couple hundred bucks a month to stay drunk on, you know, doing an air conditioning class. And there was a man who was a Korean War veteran that sat next to me in the class, and he looked at my face and he asked me about what happened to me. And I told him what had happened, and he asked me if he could buy me a cup of coffee. And I only had change to ride to, you know, from Coconut Creek over to Sample in Coral Springs. Change for the bus. And I said, "Yeah, okay." And so I went with him. That man started talking to me about alcoholism. Nobody had ever talked to me about alcoholism before. All anybody had ever talked to me about is, "Why don't you behave? Why are you a F up, you know? Why can't you be like your brother? Why can't you do the right thing?" You know, I was in trouble my whole life. My whole life I was in trouble. My whole life I was the black sheep. I was the wrong guy. I was the kid your mother told you to stay away from. And he didn't even tell me that he was a member of this program. But I found that out, and he became my first sponsor. His name was Kenny. And I used to go to the dog track over in Pompano with him, you know. So he could handicap the horses and read the big book. And I was riding home on the bus, and I was thinking about how my life had always been a mess, why I was always a problem all the time. I couldn't understand how come I was always in a problem. Asking myself, what's my problem, you know? And it was like a voice that was inside my head that wasn't my voice. It said, "You're an alcoholic like the man's talking about." And I said to myself, "Yeah, And I went home. We had phone books in those days, 1973. We didn't have phones that told you who was calling you or who you were calling. They just dialed, you know, phones. And I opened the first page of the phone book, and AA was right there. AA Intergroup, Broward County Intergroup. And they said, oh, there's a meeting right down the street from your house tonight. But it was in a Catholic church. And I ain't too crazy for the church and clergy that was always whooping my butt all the time. And so I went over there, and I stood in the bushes, you know. I was 21 years old. I had hair down to here and a beard down to here. And I watched all these middle-aged squares going into the back door of this Catholic church. And I thought, what in the hell am I doing? These people don't even look like me. They're old. And the greeter saw me lurking around out there, and he went and got me, and he brought me into the meeting, and he introduced me to all these old squares, and they had put me at the table, and they started talking to, and guess what? They were nice to me, and I wasn't used to anybody being nice to me. See, I'm the kind of guy that if you took me to your bar, your bartender would tell you, don't bother bringing him back. Don't bother coming back if he's coming with you. Because I'm loud, I'm obnoxious, I'm arrogant, and I'm 5'7", but give me some whiskey, and I think I'm 7'5". And I'm looking for a heavy ashtray that I may put over somebody's head. And I started thinking. You see, I'm a great thinker. I've always been a very clever, smart, thinking guy who can figure stuff out real fast, okay? And I figured out right then, you know. I figured it out real quick. I looked right up there at those steps on the wall, and it said I had a problem with alcohol. And, yeah, I could see that. I could see that. I could see that because, you know, look at all the trouble I was in. Look at the blackouts. I had a trouble with shooting dope, but I didn't shoot dope anymore. And, well, I got the answer. We're just not going to drink, okay? We're just not going to drink, and everything's going to be fine. Everything's going to be wonderful. And I don't need any of the rest of this. You know, these other squares might need this. But what I really need is I need a place to hang around besides a bar. Because I got to go in front of a judge. I'm thinking now. And it would be a good idea to hang around here with these old squares. It'd go good with the judge, I'm sure. So I'll be cool. And I won't drink. And there was no N.A. in Fort Lauderdale in 1973. And the only place for dope fiends to go was to Alcoholics Anonymous. And I always tell this story in my story because it's pertinent to what we're talking about with this first step. They would say in Alcoholics Anonymous, we don't drink and we don't take any mind or mood altering drugs. That was for the benefit of the dope fiends in the room. Well, I got out in my car. I reached underneath my seat and I pulled my bag of weed out and I rolled me a nice big fat one. And I started toking on that, and I thought to myself, you know, this doesn't alter your mind or your mood. It enhances it. This is a mind and mood enhancing drug, not altering. Do you understand why I tell this story? Because it's not about the substance. It's about the thinking. I am a master of rationalization and justification so I can soothe my conscience, minimize my guilt, and give me the ability to do whatever I want to do. Anything that I think is going to fit with what I want. Because all that's important to me, to this alcoholic, all that was important is me getting what I want. Because I want what I want when I want it, and I want it my way, and I want it right now. And I will do what? I will comply I'm willing to comply. I'm wonderful at complying. Just get me in a jackpot. Put me in a bear trap. Oh, I'll start whining and crying and complaining, you know. My poor mother was a wonderful woman, but she almost loved me and my sister to death. My sister's got 9 more months than me because I took her to her first meeting and then went and got drunk afterwards. But my mother, she went to Al-Anon, and they said, you know, you got to cut those two loose. And she said, F you. Those are my children. I'm not cutting them loose. And she was a nice woman, came from a nice family. And she used to come down, and I drank in the worst places. The worse it was, the better I liked it. And she would look for me all over these nasty joints, come in there searching for me. Sometimes I'd see her coming down the street through the window. I'd run and hide in the bathroom. She'd come in there and she'd say, I know he's in here. And I know y'all got drugs in your pocket. And if you don't get him out, I'm calling the cops. And they'd come and get me and throw me out. So, go with your mother. And I'd go home, cry and whine, carry on about how sorry I was. I'm never going to do it again. And as soon as she got me well, feeling good, off I was gone. I remember one time I'm out. I used to hitch all over. I'm out on the road. I run into some other bum. And I says, what you doing, man? I'm just out on the road. I says, hey, you want to go to the Keys? We're up outside. We're on I-10 outside New Orleans. I said, come on, we go down to Pompano. I says, my mother down there, she'll put us up. And then we'll go to Key West, you know. We'll really get good time in Key West, you know. And I had a beard and long hair. I hadn't seen my mother. I'll never forget as long as I live. I went to the door and knocked on the door, and my mother opened the door and looked right in my face, and she said, can I help you? And I said, it's me, Ma. Oh, my God, what'd you do to yourself? And who's this bum? I said, that's my buddy. One night, that's it. One night. But, you know, I got in front of that judge. I got in front of that judge, and that judge asked me the right question. He said to me, what's your problem, son? What is your problem? Well, I knew exactly what to tell him. You wanted me to say it to have a seat in here. I'm Tom, and I'm an alcoholic. I'm complying, see? I'm very good at complying. If you notice, there's a theme going on here, all right? And so I says, but you know, Your Honor, I'm going to those meetings, and if you just give me a break, I promise you, you will not see me here again. And that judge did the worst thing he could have done. He gave me that break. And what that break taught me was, my con job just worked. My compliance just worked and got me what I wanted. And do you know that I tried to work that for 10 years? 10 years. Every time I get in a jackpot. You know, when I got here at 21, a whole lot of things had not happened to me yet. I mean, I used to compare. How many 20-somethings do you think were in AA in Fort Lauderdale in 73? Okay? Let me tell you something. The young people of AA in the early 70s and stuff, they were in their 40s and 50s. Those were the young people in AA. There was a few of us 20-somethings that were smoking dope and, you know, not drinking because we'd go into blackouts and get thrown in jail. And so I always drank again. Once I got all my stuff back, got everything fixed, you know, got a license back, got a place to live back, got a car back, got a girlfriend back, got a job back. Ba-ba-da-ba-da-ba-da-ba-da-ba. It's the same story over and over and over again. It's a revolving door. But you see, alcoholism, the disease of alcoholism, has a little trick for you. If you don't die from it, It's called progression. And that progression kicked my ass. The first time I was here 10 months, and then it was 8 months, and then 6 months, and then 4 months, and then a few months, and then a couple months, and then a few weeks, and then a few days, until after 10 years, I couldn't even get a day. And after 10 years of doing this, the blackouts were so terrible. I'm coming out of blackouts, driving out in the middle of the Everglades in the middle of the night, 200 miles from here, you know, not knowing where I am, trying to find roadsides to find my way back, coming out of blackouts, standing in a bar, come out of a blackout talk, looking at you going, who are you? I wouldn't even know what town I was in. And I would go to Alcoholics Anonymous when I finally got over the fear, because my great idea to control these blackouts was just keep shooting cocaine. If I had enough cocaine, that was my great thinking. See, I told you, I'm a wonderful thinker. I got this all figured out. You just got to have enough coke to shoot, and you can drink all you want, and you won't go in a blackout. But, you know, unfortunately, that's like the booze is like, the coke's like a dam. And they get all the booze just gets to be too much, and it just busts the dam, and I'd just go out. I'd be bruised and rolled by everybody, you know, and be on the street, you know. And I would go to the old Delray Beach Central House. That's where I got sober. And I would sit in there and I'd tell those people, I'm never drinking again. I'm done. And do you know, I wasn't lying. This is what we call delusion. It's not denial, brothers and sisters. It ain't denial. Denial is a therapy term. We don't use denial in Alcoholics Anonymous. It is delusion. We do not know the truth from the false. We really believe our crazy minds. And I really believed I was done. But I'm getting up. And I'm leaving. I'm not going to hang around with these AA people. Because, you know, these AA people are always trying to tell you how to run your life. And I don't want nobody telling me how to run my life. I know how to run my life. Nobody needs to tell me how to run my life. You see, there's this line in the big book, defiance is my outstanding characteristic, in case you haven't picked up on that yet. I'm fighting everything and everybody my whole life. I'm at war with the world. I am what you call an aggressive alcoholic. There's nothing passive about me. You know, I am going to jump down your throat with both boots to prove you're wrong and I'm right. And that's all that matters. And the old timers used to drive me crazy in AA. I'd have fight and argue with them all the time, and they'd, in their loving, tolerant way, pat me on the back and say, it's okay, Tom. You got a right to be wrong. I used to think, what is that supposed to mean? What an insulting thing to say to a man. I have a right to be wrong. No, I don't. No, see, I don't have a right to be wrong. Deep down in me, there's this thing that says, you have to be right. You can't be wrong. They have to be wrong. Even if you got to kill them to prove to them that they're wrong. Some of us get here suicidal. I got here homicidal. And all that is just trying to find somebody to whack you. I got a long list of fighting cops. I would do things like pull the fire alarm and wait for the cops to get there. And the cop would get out of the car and look at me and go, did you pull that fire alarm? Spit right in his face and say, yeah, what are you going to do about it? You catch a beating easy that way. You know? I don't know why I thought that was a good idea. Maybe it had something to do with delusion. Maybe it had something to do with finally, ending up, I'll tell you what happened. I come out of this blackout. I had gone to the Sail Inn over in Delray. My boys from Delray, they know Sail Inn. And I says, I'm just going in here to listen to the music, you know, and I'm gonna drink Coke. And then I'd start looking at myself in the mirror, because I love to look at myself in the mirror. And I'm start looking at the bottles, you know, and I start looking at the clock on the wall. And then I start thinking. Remember, I'm a good thinker. And I'm going to, I got this figured out. Figured out. I'm just going to stare at that clock. And I don't care if the most beautiful woman sits next to me. I'm not going to talk to her. I'm not going to talk to the barmaid. I'm not going to talk to anybody. I'm going to stare at that clock. And I'm going to make myself just drink for an hour. And I'm going to get up from this bar stool. And I'm going to leave here. Do you know how insane that is? How many years I had been telling myself that I'm now going to figure out how to drink successfully? I had tried everything. And come out of blackout, in the weeds again, up on Federal Highway. I'm walking. I'm in Boynton Beach. I'm fishing around. It's wintertime. Inside my Levi jacket, I find a reefer, smoke that. I'm loaded. I'm still drunk, too. I see a building they're building, and there's a bunch of H-clamps. You know, H-clamps put on tie beams. I take that H-clamp, and I heave it through the big picture window. It's 6 o'clock in the morning, Joe Al's, the little restaurant there. Guy comes running out. He says, I'm an off-duty cop in Ocean Ridge. I'm calling the Boynton PD. And I said, you better get away from me. I'll hit you with one of these. And there's a park across the street, and the seawall's there. And I look at the seawall, and I think, I'll just swim to the other side out of their jurisdiction. I made it to the seawall, and all three of them were on me and put me in cuffs and arrested me for attempted burglary. And they brought me down to the Boynton City Jail, waiting to go to gun club again. I'm a good stockader and gun clubber, you know. And I'm sitting there. I'm sobered up now, and I'm thinking, what is my problem? Why do I keep having problems in my life? And that little voice came back, and it said, because you're crazy. And the reason you're crazy is because you think you can run your life, but you can't. But you think you can. That's why you're insane. And I said, that's the truth about me. The truth about me is I can't stop when I start taking it. And I cannot run my life. I cannot run my life by staying sober. That's what I wanted to believe. I wanted to believe what that second half of the first step meant. Was that all I had to do was just not drink and I control my life. But you see, I haven't had a drink or a drug in 41 years. And my life is still unmanageable because I have alcoholism. I don't have alcohol-wasm. It ain't a wasm. And I wake up every day with untreated alcoholism. And I have to treat my alcoholism. I have to realize that my life is unmanageable, but it's not unmanaged. It's managed by a power greater than me through the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, a day at a time. I had to surrender. I had to stop this compliance. And I had to surrender unconditionally. We can't make terms or conditions with our alcoholism. It does not work. You know, I always tell them it's like when the Japs got bombed with the atom bomb, okay? They didn't make no negotiations, okay? It was over. It was over. It's over. Unconditionally over. And it has to be that way all the time. Because this alcoholism, like my good friend Ronnie, who's gone now, used to say, just because the monkey's off your back, that don't mean the circus left town. Thanks for letting me share it.
Let's thank Tom one more time. We have tonight's session and all past speaker podcasts for free at alcoholicsandgod.org, and there's some QR codes on the back table if you want a link to Apple Podcasts. Again, I'd like to invite everybody to our Monday night Big Book study in this room at 7:15 and on Zoom now. And for those who'd like to thank the speaker, please line up down the center aisle. We're going to say the Lord's Prayer seated. And it's up here if you don't know it. Our Father,
who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done, on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our trespasses, as we forgive those who trespass against us. And lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. For thine is the kingdom, the power, and the glory, forever and ever.
Thirsty bodies aching. I am desperately in need of restoration. Yeah, and I am ready for you to take me higher. Yeah, the only thing that I can do. Doesn't matter how hard I try, but with you I become.
and oh, when you're smiling, when you're smiling, the whole world smiles with you, baby. Yes, when you're laughing. When you're laughing, yes, the sun comes shining through. But when you're crying, you bring on the rain. Stop your sighing, baby, and be happy again. Yes, and keep on smiling. Keep on smiling, baby. And I hope.
Thank you. This little light of mine, I'm going to let it shine. Let it shine, 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 let it shine.
Michael Chase, here's that song you've been asking me for a million years. I finally pulled it out the corners of my mind, and here you go. Song is. God bless. I love you, Mike Chase. Bye.
I think you know this one, don't you? Shine your light on me tonight. Minnesota. Thank you very much for staying.